The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, an Apple Premier partner. TechServe has been supporting New Yorkers for 29 years with Mac repairs and upgrades, including data recovery, liquid damage, hard drive issues, general troubleshooting, and more. TechServe.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and wow, this hour, political history unfolding in real time. From Super Tuesday to Bloody Thursday, we are watching as the Republican Party is trying to take down its own front runner with an all-hands-on-deck political sacrifice. Is there a doctor in the house? Well, not anymore. Ben Carson is out of the race as of today and probably relieved at this point. Mitt Romney gave a speech today tearing apart every aspect of Donald Trump's record and grasp of national affairs. And Donald Trump, shimmering with his recently acquired Super Tuesday frontrunner credentials, responded to Romney at a political rally in Maine a few hours later. Let's start with Romney, though. Evoking the gods of American conservatism, the failed 2012 presidential candidate went after Donald Trump's character, his business acumen and morality, his truthfulness, and even whether he has any intelligence. For the anti-abortion Republican Conservative Party, this was a public attempt to abort Donald Trump's aims at the Republican nomination 9 months before Election Day. Listen, here's Romney assailing Trump's business sense.
His bankruptcies have crushed small businesses and the men and women who work for them. He inherited his business. He didn't create it. And whatever happened to Trump Airlines? How about Trump University? And then there's Trump Magazine and Trump Vodka and Trump Steaks and Trump Mortgage. A business genius he is not.
Romney also called him a liar and a fraud, profane and repugnant morally. This was the same person who Romney was happy to have endorsing him back in 2012 when Romney said that Trump's business instincts were exactly what the country needed. But speaking today, Romney said for Trump to get anywhere near the White House would be an instant global crisis.
He's not of the temperament of the kind of stable, thoughtful person we need as leader. His imagination must not be married to real power.
Kimberly Lobey of Willoughby, Ohio, voted for Mitt Romney in 2012, and we got her immediate impressions of Romney's attempted Trump takedown speech.
I have to say that I wonder if what he did will only serve to strengthen Trump's position, because most of the people voting for Trump at this point are bucking establishment politics, and that's how they're looking at Romney. He almost came off as a little bit of a bully, insulting the intelligence of the people that are backing Trump at this point.
But Donald Trump made that point himself a few hours later in his own fiery speech in Maine.
Now, I heard, and I saw just a little bit of it, but I heard that Mitt Romney made a fairly long speech. And I mean, honestly, I thought I'll just address it quickly because it's irrelevant. Look, Mitt is a failed candidate. He failed. He failed horribly. The third debate. He failed badly. That was a race, I have to say, folks, that should have been won. That was a race that absolutely should have been won. And I don't know what happened to him. He disappeared.
Well, for the Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, this is political theater you can only dream of. But a GOP endgame for Trump? Doubtful, he says.
Absolutely remarkable, historic in every way. You've never seen anything like it. The past nominee of the Republican Party, as you said, doing his very best to help in the 11th hour attempted takedown of the person who is now the presumptive nominee, not the nominee yet, but the presumptive nominee of his party, all against a backdrop, John, of 7 years of the Republican establishment courting the exact anger, the exact vehemence that Donald Trump has come to represent. Part of the irony of Mitt Romney being on that stage and delivering such a powerful indictment of Donald Trump is how Mitt Romney helped to court and create the phenomenon that is Donald Trump, and he made absolutely no acknowledgement of it. Some of this has to do with raising money from Wall Street donors to put up ads. It has to do with getting respected establishment, well-known high name ID politicians out in front of the public like Mitt Romney that you just saw. But the organization really stops there because, John, where does the organization go when the field against Donald Trump is still split as it is, when Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz and for that matter, John Kasich, are still fighting each other for the right to challenge Trump directly? All of the talk, all of the speeches and all of the money raised don't make a bit of difference if Trump goes into that convention with a majority of delegates. And if he goes into the convention on the cusp of a majority of delegates, you have the added liability of trying to unseat the person who won the majority of the Republican primary and stick a thumb into the eye of millions and millions of Republican voters who want Trump. There's no good way out of this.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent. There's a lot of American political laundry on display for the rest of the world, that's for sure. This isn't the kind of attention that the U.S. is accustomed to as the old leader of the free world. It's more head-scratching as the rest of the world tries to figure out what exactly is going on in the U.S. election. Donald Trump's Super Tuesday momentum feels outrageous to some world leaders and overseas observers. Here's British Prime Minister David Cameron.
I think his remarks are divisive, stupid, and wrong. And I think if he came to visit our country, I think he'd unite us all against him.
I'm a unifier. I know people are going to find that a little bit hard to believe, but believe me, I am a unifier.
Donald Trump wants to be unifier in chief. Friend of oligarchs, Russian President Vladimir Putin, seems to get Trump.
He is a very flamboyant man, very talented, no doubt about that. He is an absolute leader of the presidential race, as we see it today.
But observers in China think Donald Trump is more like an early April Fool's Day joke. Brian Yu is the CEO and founder of Business Connect China.
Most of Chinese think Donald Trump is a joke because he just did something or say something. It's just too much. It's like carried away. We will talk what's going on with the U.S. Democracy.
But Trump may be better than Hillary Clinton from the Chinese perspective.
Her image in China has always been on the tough side. I mean, most of us think Hillary is pretty tough on China. Maybe more confrontational in terms of Sino-U.S. relationship.
Brian Yu is a risk taker and an investor, and he knows how to place a big bet. Yet, even for him, Trump is a big unknown.
But Donald Trump is really a wild card. I mean, nobody knows how he's gonna do, right? He's a big name, actually, because of The Apprentice. People know about this, but other than that, I mean, nobody really knows him.
South of the U.S. border, the Trump message has been disturbing, with talk of a wall on the Mexican border and accusations that Latin Americans are trying to offload their drug addicts and prostitutes to the north. Writer and historian Enrique Krause, based in Mexico City, signed a letter condemning Trump's language.
If Donald Trump turns out to be the candidate for the Republican Party in the United States, and if he wins, as a Mexican, I can say I am deeply worried of the possible nightmarish consequences. There would be an increased militarization of the border. There would be much less cooperation between the two governments concerning crime and drugs.
We turn now to a voice with considerable experience decoding curious American behavior. Edward Lucas is senior editor at The Economist and author of The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Edward, your thoughts?
I think it's too easy to say that Americans are out of their minds. All sorts of countries elect really wacky politicians or have really wacky politicians. We see Marine Le Pen, far-right candidate in France, who may well be the next president there. But for years, we had Silvio Berlusconi, who was a clown of really Trumpian proportions, running Italy and Italians voting for him because he was amusing and made them feel good. So I think it's easier to decry Donald Trump as a person from outside. What we always have to remember is that we really need America. You are our indispensable security partner and our indispensable trading partner. And so this really matters to us. It's just we don't vote.
Is Trump significantly worse than an extremely unpopular figure like George W. Bush?
I think George Bush got a very unfair treatment from the Europeans because his perceived inarticulacy really let him down in European eyes. People thought he was sort of the kind of hick who must be stupid because he spoke in this rather, with this rather fractured grammar and syntax. And I thought that was kind of snooty and unfair, really. But he was very unpopular. in Europe, particularly as the Iraq war disaster unfolded. But I think looking back, we really need American presidents who are deeply engaged in European security. So Reagan really cared about toppling communism. Clinton, who was very popular, believed in expanding NATO. George Bush also expanded NATO and paid a lot of attention to the security problems of the European continent. And Barack Obama has also done quite a lot. And I think what really worries me about Trump is not his off-the-wall comments and his rudeness and vulgarity and so on. It's the isolationism. It's the idea that he just isn't really interested in shouldering burdens with other countries. And we here in Europe really need America as our partner in all sorts of ways. And both Trump's isolationism and actually some of the other Republican candidates and Bernie Sanders, that all worries me.
There's often been a distinction between the way the American government speaks to the world and the American people. And of course, there's the caricature of the ugly American tourist around the world. What do you think the Trump success says about the American people and particularly the American electorate?
I have to say, I've never believed in this stereotype of the ugly American tourist. And when I see the way British tourists behave abroad, I think that there's plenty of targets for criticism there too. I think that what Trump does do is feed a bit of a caricature of the kind of braggart, know-nothing, self-obsessed tycoon. He's like the kind of villain you might see in a Hollywood movie about a kind of bad capitalist who's going to meet his downfall. And of course, that's a stereotype that Americans would find amusing and unpleasant, just as Europeans would. So I think he does play to a certain strand of anti-Americanism in Europe, which will find him particularly horrific. As I say, the thing that really worries me is not the things that he does, but the things he says he won't do, like, for example, being engaged in the rest of the world's security.
Edward Lucas is senior editor at The Economist and author of The New Cold War, Putin's Russia and the Threat to the West. Great to talk to you, Edward. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
About 380,000 babies are born significantly before their due dates every year in the United States. It's an experience no parent would wish on anyone, even though today doctors can perform medical miracles on preemies that never had a chance of survival even a decade ago. But the technological developments have leaped ahead of the need to communicate to worried parents what's going on, the consequences that early delivery may produce in a child later in life. These are difficult conversations about even more difficult life and death decisions that Jenny Gold, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, says are not being handled well in many cases. Gold says the NICU is a brave new world of early childhood development that good old-fashioned communication has not caught up with yet.
Most kids who go to the NICU do fine. A lot of these kids are slightly premature, or maybe they have fluid in their lungs. Technology has come so far that, you know, a lot of them really are able to make it and lead pretty normal lives. We're talking here about a small subset of babies who end up there who are really likely to have poor outcomes, either not making it or making it but surviving with severe disabilities.
How are decisions made in a neonatal intensive care unit situation? Continue with the care, to end care? How is the outcome evaluated as to whether this is going to be a so-called normal baby or not?
It's so hard to make those decisions because the outcome is really unknown. For example, if you save a baby at 24 weeks gestation, which is pretty early, some of those babies go on to do just fine, about 30% of them. But the rest of them who survive end up with severe disabilities. It's really hard to know which baby is going to be which. And you can give parents sort of all the statistics you want, but there's an incredible human capacity to hope that your baby is going to be the one that does okay. And end-of-life decision-making for babies is really different than it is for adults. You know, in the last few years in this country, we've had a rigorous conversation about end-of-life care for adults.
So it should be based on what we think the patient would have wanted. I mean, some folks say, what if grandpa could wake up and for 15 minutes he was completely lucid and we could explain to him exactly what's going on and he told us what he wanted us to do. What do we think he would say? But substituted judgment works only for people who have at one point been competent to make decisions. So in the case of small children, in the case of babies, substituted judgment is not really an option.
It's not an option, but it's also unavoidable in a sense. Who is that speaking?
So that's Dr. Mark Mercurio, and he is chief of neonatal perinatal medicine at Yale New Haven Hospital. What he's basically saying there is that for adults, there's the opportunity to sort of imagine what that adult wants. Well, that's just not possible for babies. We don't know what a baby would want. So it comes down to what the family and the parent wants. Their job is to sort of project forward. What would they want for their child? What do they think a good quality of life would be? But it becomes a larger and larger circle. So it's not just what's good for the baby, but it's also what's good for the family. Are there other children? Are there other children with special needs? What can this family handle? Religious beliefs come into the picture. Concerns about divorce, concerns about finances. All of these things enter the picture. It's a much more complicated circle of decision making.
And it would require that the level of communication, the awareness on all sides would be at the absolute top level. But that's really, really hard to know. And here's David Magnus, who's a doctor and director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
If you have a conversation, you may think you're doing a really great job of communicating and have a good conversation. But the only way to really know is to really collect the data. And it's something that we really don't do. If you think about it, you get on the phone to talk to almost anybody, you hear this call may be recorded for quality improvement purposes. But we don't do that routinely for informed consent processes, right? We don't do that for patient communication. We could, and when studies are done to do that, they all find the same thing, which is it's pretty bad.
And what he means when he says informed consent processes, what he means is he's asking doctors are checking with parents what they want to do going forward. Do they want to take the next step? Do they want to do the heart surgery? Do they want to continue intensive care when things aren't looking good? Those are all steps along the way when decisions have to be made. And then for each of those decisions, the doctor really has to explain to the parent what are all of the options and what does that parent want. It's so complicated for anyone to understand, especially in a time when you're just in a state of shock and real grief that the outcome for your newborn baby and all of the hopes that you have for your child may not come true. So what Dr. Magnus is saying there is we don't know how good doctors are doing at having these conversations. They're really difficult. And what we do know is that in general, they don't necessarily tend to be great at it. It's not something that is necessarily taught in medical school. It's not a real focus. Though I will say that is starting to change. They are starting to teach more of that.
In this particular case with these babies, the language, it seems, almost fails us as well. Here's Deirdre Miller, who's a nurse at Oregon Health Sciences University Hospital in Portland, Oregon.
When we sit down at family meetings, if an infant is going to be maybe developmentally or physically delayed, we use that word, delayed. And we think that everybody has a very clear understanding of what delayed means. And then we had a family who we use those words for, and later when it was just me and the mom in the room, she was like, well, the nice thing about being delayed is that it's like a train. The train will show up eventually. It's just going to be late. That's not how we use that word.
Absolutely. I mean, these conversations are so hard, and I think it's hard for doctors to sort of even want to say exactly what's possible. Delayed is a total euphemism. It's not necessarily telling a parent what's actually going to happen. And again, parents hear what they want to hear, and what they want to hear is your baby's going to be okay. But you hear from this nurse, Deirdre Miller, that there's all these miscommunications that happen, and if a parent is making decisions based on those misunderstandings, I mean, that's really an issue. And, you know, it's a complicated issue, right? I mean, basically, you're asking a parent to decide on some level what kind of risk of disability they're willing to accept. And that's a really hard question. And ethically, it's a difficult question as well. I mean, one really positive thing hospitals have started to do is have parents trying to make these decisions go and talk to other parents who have children with disabilities that may look like what their kids have. And that at least allows them to get some semblance of an idea of what this all means.
Jenny Gold is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Jenny, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering tech services for small business owners like PC setup and repair. More at staples.com/tech services. Staples, make more happen.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Even when it's not life-threatening, parents with babies in the neonatal intensive care unit experience stress that can last a lifetime. Kate Hopper's older daughter, Stella, was born prematurely back in 2003. Kate, the author of Ready for Air, A Journey Through Premature Motherhood, now volunteers in the NICU, helping parents who are making tough decisions about their baby's health and future.
We were so lucky that Stella was 32 weeks, so she was just, you know, 8 weeks early, which sounds odd to say because it was still such a hard thing for us. She was only 3 pounds, but it was very much a sense of, like, they don't know what's going to happen. There was a sense that you don't ask, really, you know, how is she going to be okay? There was only one point after I found out that Stella had had a small brain bleed. I said to the doctor, like, what does this mean? Like, I was so, like, I need to know what this means for my kid down the line. And she was kind of, you know, well, you know, she'll probably be fine. But if she's in grade school and has some math processing problems, like, get it checked out. And that sense that the nurses always say, how is she? They say, she's having a good day. Because they knew better than I knew at the time that in the NICU, anything can happen.
When you think back now, do you think you had the decisions sort of pre-thought through on some of the outcomes that could have happened? Nowadays, they're much more careful, it seems, maybe not careful enough based on some reporting, though, to have things spelled out a little bit so that if you go down a particular road, everybody knows what page we're on. Did you feel as though there were some scenarios that you, in fact, had no idea, and if you were to do it again, you would have a much clearer sense, what decision would be made?
I mean, I had no idea, you know, and especially because I was sick. I developed severe preeclampsia. So those first couple days of her life, too, I was in the hospital and I was very ill. And so I felt like I was coming out of a fog into this totally different world and one for which I was not at all prepared. And we didn't really talk about that, like, okay, if this happens, then we do this. And so I think that behind the scenes, all of that was kind of understood from the medical professions, but we didn't entertain it. And actually, I probably couldn't emotionally go there at the time because I was like the thought of contemplating her death. You know, I was actually trying to not love her, not fall in love with this child because I was so worried
Something
would happen to her.
Oh, for
and
heaven's sakes, seriously?
And not in a sort of conscious way. It was only when she did develop sepsis and I thought, she's going to die, that I realized, oh, my God, I've loved her all along and she can't leave me now. Like, I've just realized this. I'm not going to hold back anymore. And so that was the moment that also this kind of maternal instinct kicked in for me.
How old is Stella?
Stella is 12 and a half and she's awesome. She's great, great health, soccer player, loves math. You know, she's doing really well. We were very lucky.
Do you ever look at her when she's asleep in her bed and ask yourself a question if there's anything in there?
Yeah, well, and I do all the time. And I wrote her this letter on her 10th birthday. And it was that for so many years, I looked at her and would see kind of that preemie, like on her birthday, I would revisit all of those, you know, at 6 a.m., this is what happened, at 7 a.m., this is what happened. And then when she turned 10, it wasn't like that anymore. It was replaced by different memories of her, you know, doing a double scissors or, you know, doing all of these different soccer moves and holding her little sister. And so that has faded for me, but it's still there. I mean, still when I go into the NICU and I see a 3-pound baby, it feels like I've just been punched. So the power of that experience, it really holds on to parents.
Kate Hopper is the mother of two and author of Ready for Air. Her daughter, Stella, is 12 and a half?
Yes, 12 and a half.
Kate, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
P. Pity the American people trying to make any sense of this.
Excuse me, he called me a liar and interrupted the whole time.
Do I not get a response? But hey, any American can just turn down the sound or change the channel. What if you had to sit there? What if it was your job to get every word down exactly as spoken? Oh, and one more thing, you have to do it in real time. Amy Bolin is a veteran in the captions business, and she knows rudeness, like this 1992 Democratic debate between Jerry Brown and Bill Clinton.
I was shocked by it because I don't think someone in government should be funneling money into his wife's law firm.
Governor Clinton, you were poking your finger at him. Well, he poked it back. It's your turn, Governor
Jerry
Clinton.
Comes here with his family wealth and his $1,500.
Amy Bolin is a manager of captioner training and is a captioner herself at Vitac, the country's biggest captioning firm that has captioned many debates this cycle, including the last GOP debate in Houston and tonight's Republican debate in Detroit. She joins me now. Welcome, Amy.
Thank you, John.
You know, there's a lot of talk in America about the decline of civil discourse. It occurs to me that the decline of civil discourse has had a very direct impact on your life.
I would agree.
When did you begin to notice that your job was getting harder?
You know, that really has changed over the years. I've been captioning for 26 years. And the decorum, there was more of a typical format where people listen to somebody, let them finish the end of their sentence, and, you know, the normal discussion. But over the years, it's changed. People talk faster. They're more eager to get their thoughts out before somebody else finishes. And with the debates, you add the factor that it's timed. So there's only so many minutes or so much time for each person to respond. So they're talking quicker. But what's surprising is that other people are interjecting while they're talking.
The cable shows, I imagine, were the first indicator that this was going to get harder and harder as time went on.
In my experience, that's what I noticed, because there's more competition. If you've got three or four cable stations with 24-hour news and they're trying to keep your attention, they're moving quickly. There's always live breaking news. There may be an interview on one topic, and then they quickly jump to the other topic. So there's not an hour dedicated to one topic. It might be 3 minutes with a guest and then completely different topic, and then they're breaking them with more live breaking news. So I feel like definitely as the cable channels expanded and there were more and more of those and more competition, it did change the nature of what we're writing.
Well, let's remind you and take you back, and maybe this wasn't one that you captioned personally, but I know you remember moments like this. This was the Houston debate on February 25th.
Gentlemen,
Wolf, I'm going to ask that my time not be deducted when
time
he's
is
yelling
at me. Control.
Okay, now.
The latest debate,
well,
gentlemen,
hold on,
please.
I'm going to get my answer. He doesn't get to yell at me.
I want
to
move on. These are the rules.
Excuse me, he called me a liar and then interrupted the whole time.
You had a chance.
Do I not get a response?
You have.
Do I not get a response without being interrupted?
You'll get plenty of response, so stand by.
My name was
I want to talk about ISIS right now.
33 seconds, Amy.
John, you're making me sweat here. My palms are getting sweaty all over again.
I'm weeping for you.
That's a really challenging situation. The truth of the matter is we really can only write one speaker at a time. So, you know, honestly, there's not a captioner out there that could have written every single one of those words from every single different speaker. There are some times when if you really just cannot even discern one individual person speaking, you would have to put up maybe a parenthetical that said overlapping speakers. But we try as hard as we can to be as near verbatim as possible. That is a really challenging situation right there.
I mean, do you ever have the temptation to just write unintelligible? I'm sure you have a key that says unintelligible, right?
Actually, we're very careful not to ever kind of insert our judgment or any of our opinions. So if we have to put up a parenthetical, it would be something like overlapping speakers or maybe inaudible. We'd never write unintelligible. We just wouldn't do that.
So when you listen to that bickering between Trump and Rubio and Carson and Cruz and Kasich and Wolf Blitzer of CNN, there's someone somewhere in a living room in front of a captioner machine who is not only sweating, but possibly just, you know, coming apart at the seams.
Possibly crying, right?
Yeah.
Yes. They're in their home office, and they're, you know, very intent. sometimes you don't even realize it when it's happening. When it's over, it's kind of a big sigh of relief, but you're so intent on listening and writing that you don't really let it affect you.
Are your hands sore?
You know what? Your hands can get tired. It's very fast. Sometimes we're writing up to maybe 300 words a minute. So to do that for a sustained period of time is exhausting. Not just your hands, your shoulders, your body gets tense because you're nervous. And, you know, the faster it gets, the more you tense up.
And after that February 25th debate, I mean, you needed a shower. My goodness. I mean, this isn't just for hearing impaired. You know, closed captioning is an important communication tool for people who are watching in all kinds of environments. They should speak better so that your job is easier, so that more people can hear what's going on, right?
True. In reality, even people who aren't looking at the captions, who are just listening, can't probably make a lot out of what's being said with everybody talking over top of one another. But it would be nice if there was some decorum in a setting like that so that we could have our captions be perfect and have them be absolutely verbatim, but there's no way for us to control that.
What are the rules, finally, before we go? You have a certain amount of time to get it right and a certain ability to correct if you make an error before it actually goes on the screen. Explain.
We are writing on our steno machine, and it's translating immediately what we call real time, and then that data is being transmitted either through a phone line or an IP connection to an encoding device in that network control room. So our translation happens, and we have about a second to fix a stroke before it would go out. There's no one editing behind us. It's all live. It's all real time. So if we make a mistake, the audience gets to see that mistake. We never think they're funny, but sometimes our audience thinks the mistakes are funny.
But that's a pretty high-pressure environment, even when people are speaking politely.
It's a very high-pressure environment. We want to get it right every time.
Well, I have to say, Trump, Rubio, Carson, Cruz, Kasich, and Wolf Blitzer all owe you folks a lunch or, I don't know, a bottle of Ambien, something, tea at a nice restaurant or something.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Amy, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Amy Boland is a manager of captioner training and a veteran captioner herself at VITAC. And here's something to take with you today. Call it peaceful wisdom from a Russian sage. Priests have cats. Cats have priests. Sometimes cats even live in a church. This timeless truth is the simple and odd premise of a virally popular photo calendar that depicts Russian Orthodox priests posing with their cats. The intent is to promote modern Orthodox culture, but the calendar is not officially sanctioned by the Orthodox hierarchy. It does make the case, though, that long beards look adorable next to furry cats. If you are an actually practicing Orthodox Christian, here's a slight caution from the Russian Orthodox spokesman. I don't see a big sin here, he says, but I wouldn't put such a calendar up on my wall. Remember, you can take us with you, subscribe to our podcast, find us on iTunes, take us with you on your commute home from work. It's a great way to stay up on the news and to stay with the conversation. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.